We are joined live here in the KODX studios by both Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Welcome back, Jav.
Yeah, welcome back.
It is nice to be back.
And it looks like
I had a crappy spring. How about you guys?
Is that both figuratively and literally?
Lately, yes. But we won't go into that on the air.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's good to have you back. And Maria's been trying to keep up.
No, she's been doing an awesome job. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
So as you well know, the city has continued to, speaking of crappy, continued its downward spiral in a lot of different ways, but there are some bright spots. So let's start out with Mayor Durkin.
Speaking of circling the drain, yes.
The Seattle Times reported this week that Mayor Jenny Durkin has set up a panel to help her formulate a response to Judge James Robart's rejection of the new Seattle Police Officers Guild union contract. As part of the police reform process. That panel that Durkin has set up on her own is staffed by four outside consultants hired through a Chicago-based company named 21CP Solutions, which calls themselves, quote, the preeminent team of thought leaders and change agents in modern policing, end quote. 21CP...
I'm getting nauseous already.
Yeah. 21CP has been hired as a consultant on police reform by the cities of Baltimore, Cincinnati, Sacramento, Cleveland, and Grand Rapids, and most of their staff are former police officers or police chiefs.
And I can tell you that Baltimore and Cleveland, for starters, badly needed reform.
Yeah, the four consultants...
And Sacramento, too.
The four consultants from 21CP who are sitting on the panel are Charles Ramsey, he's former police commissioner of Philadelphia, Ronald Davis, former police chief of East Palo Alto, California, and his name may sound familiar.
He was a finalist.
Yes, he was a finalist for Seattle police chief a little while back. And also Daryl Stevens is on the panel. He's former police chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department in North Carolina, and Dean Smoot, the chief counsel for the Illinois Police Officers Union. So Durkin appears to be relying on police and police union representatives to come up with ways to spin the contract and change the judge's mind, not ways to renegotiate the disciplinary piece of the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract, which is what Robart rejected.
And, you know, this is doubly disturbing because I think pretty much from the time the terms of the contract, draft contract were announced, it was entirely predictable that Robart would reject it, because it really does violate the reform process and walk back things that the city council had already passed in several significant ways. So in all likelihood, Durkin had this as a plan B in her back pocket. And of course, there's been no public process around that.
Yeah, and you know, by hiring these law enforcement consultants who've worked on changes, in some cases very incremental changes in other cities, I think she really wants to get their quote-unquote expert testimony that Seattle's contract is good enough and that that we really don't need to make further changes because these other cities that are undergoing the police reform process have not made changes as broad as ours.
And at least three of those cities that I can think of, Baltimore, Cleveland, and Sacramento, have had extremely controversial lethal police killings
in
the last several years.
They have.
So, you know, the fact that these folks have been called into those cities suggests that their real expertise is in whitewashing out of the reform process.
Yeah. Or in representing the interests of the Seattle Police Department representing the interests of the police department and the police union in negotiations on police reform.
Exactly.
Now, in ruling against a portion of the contract, Judge Robart found the city partially out of compliance with the police reform process. He set a deadline of July 15th, which is coming up here soon, for all parties to come to an agreement that would get the city back into compliance. By all parties, he meant the mayor's office, the police department, the police union, the Community Police Commission, which is the civilian oversight body created as part of the reform process, and the Department of Justice. So far, the mayor has not tried to work to sit down together with all those groups and work things out. Instead, she's just hired these four consultants to do that for her, and it's not clear that they will be able to. So we'll see what happens come June 15th.
So it sounds like a blue ribbon panel end run.
Yeah.
To me.
Mm-hmm. Essentially.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Yes, because blue ribbon panels solve everything, as we well know.
As we know, it's not true.
Apparently, it's a good gig if you can get it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure it pays well.
Yeah, a lot of perks. All right, moving on, the city council endorses the Green New Deal.
Yeah,
on Monday,
the entire city council voted to endorse a Green New Deal for Seattle, as outlined in a letter drafted by the environmental organizations Got Green and 350 Seattle. The council's endorsement letter states, quote, "We thank you for your leadership, express our support for your vision of a Green New Deal for Seattle, and commit to partnering with you to realize this vision and achieve a just and sustainable future for all Seattleites." The Green New Deal is outlined in a letter that the groups sent to the mayor and the city council asking for their endorsements. That letter states, quote, "We, the undersigned, call for the creation of a transformative Green New Deal for Seattle that will eliminate our city's climate pollution by 2030, address historical and current injustices, and create thousands of good, green, well-paying, unionized jobs. Furthermore, we urge our city leaders to create a Green New Deal investment vehicle and a Green New Deal task force, which will decide how investments will be made by no later than the end of 2019. That's a direct quote from their letter. So there is a call for actual legislation in this letter, regardless of what the Seattle Times wrote in their recent article covering this issue this week, which said that, oh, it's vague and there's no call for real legislation in there. That's actually incorrect. It will be up to the city council to create that legislation for an investment fund and to set up the task force, because, of course, Mayor Jenny Durkan has not yet endorsed the letter. I don't expect that she will, and I don't expect that she's going to draft any legislation to send to the council. Now, the letter itself lays out some areas for the task force to address, including building thousands more units of affordable housing, free electric transit in all Seattle neighborhoods, which is a nice goal. I'm not sure we can get there that very quickly, but you know, it is a good goal.
Yeah.
And transitioning our electrical grid to carbon-free energy, also a very good goal. But there's more to it, including using the economic boost of a new green energy economy to address economic inequalities and racism built into the old carbon-based energy economy. That's where those good, well-paying union jobs.
Yeah. But also, and that should dovetail with the city's race and social justice initiative. Had that not been gutted by mayors Durkan and Murray.
Yeah. So it's an argument that as the city provides incentives for new startups and businesses to work on this issue, that they make sure they create good-paying union jobs for people of all ethnicities and backgrounds. And that their services are delivered to everyone in Seattle equally, not just the neighborhoods that can afford to pay the highest rates for green energy. The letter also suggests revenue sources for the city to tap for this new fund. Included in that list is a climate emergency tax on big businesses, congestion pricing for Seattle streets, which is interesting because Got Green is a environmental group that includes a lot of communities of color within it and is particularly meant to represent communities of color in the environmental movement here in the city. So for them to suggest congestion pricing for Seattle streets makes me think that they feel it could be done in a way that is equitable for people of all income levels and communities of color.
Yeah, and that strikes me as something that's definitely not going to happen during an election year.
Yeah, it won't this year, but that's why, of course, the city council is studying it.
Right.
Now, other revenue sources include a climate emergency levy for voters to decide on, using funds from the city's general fund budget or dipping into the city's rainy day fund. And regardless of the route the council decides to take, the letter urges them to avoid regressive tax sources, which is good.
Which is pretty much everything Seattle does.
Currently, yeah. In addition, the letter urges City Attorney Pete Holmes to file charges against the fossil fuel industry, quote, for knowingly causing global warming while spending tens of millions funding climate disinformation, end quote. And it points out that 13 other jurisdictions in the U.S. are following that route already. And City Attorney Pete Holmes has said that he's keeping an eye on that case.
And I would think that State Attorney General Bob Ferguson would be interested.
Would want to get involved in that too, yeah. Now, the letter points out that cities are where most greenhouse gas emissions are produced. So cities must take the lead in transitioning to green energy. Copenhagen, for example, has already set a path for carbon neutrality by 2025, which is only 5.5 years away. I think Seattle can do the same.
Yeah, and 2030, which is was outlined in this letter, is only 11 years away. So it's
not
a, it's
far.
It is a pretty ambitious set of goals, but
not impossible.
Not impossible.
And certainly
not impossible.
Impossible. Just certainly doable.
And appropriate to the scale of the crisis.
Yes.
Also.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, we do have to treat it like an emergency because it is.
Mm-hmm. But it also emphasizes the importance of having a sane city council to be able to come up with this legislation.
Yes, because, you know, while the investment vehicle legislation, the goal is to have that by the end of the year, everything else is likely to be punted into the next year. So the composition of city council going forward is going to be hugely important in addressing this.
Yeah.
All right.
And we'll be talking more about that in the next couple of weeks.
Yes, we will.
All right. Do we want to do Olympia next or the final city council district?
Let's just go to the Olympia really quickly.
All right.
newly elected state senator Mona Das spoke at a Kent Chamber of Commerce legislative forum this week, and she talked about what she's experienced in Olympia in the past year. And this is a direct quote from her speech. After they close that door, that's when it gets real. That's when my 28 colleagues go real. And that's when I heard hate. That's when I heard misogyny and racism and sexism from people you would not expect, end quote. And by that, she means her colleagues in the Democratic Party in the Senate, in the state Senate. Apparently, you know, these are all things we would expect as a matter of course from the Republicans in the Senate. But
I can think of a few Democrats that expect it from, too. Honestly.
Yeah.
Some in the Seattle delegation.
Yeah. And she's not talking about outright racist slurs per se, but coded language that reveals racist and sexist assumptions that are part of the broader institutional racism in our society, particularly places of power like the Washington State Senate. She singled out the phrase, those people, as an example. And some listeners, of course, to this show might roll their eyes a little bit, but, you know, a phrase like those people instantly puts up a wall between the person who says that phrase and anyone in the room who is not like them.
Remember the trouble that Joe Biden has been dealing with for the past couple of weeks by citing the terms boy and son. It's the same kind of very coded language with assumptions behind it.
Yeah.
And it means a lot to the people who are on the receiving end.
Yeah, and used in certain contexts, especially when discussing political policies that may disproportionately affect women and people of color, it's a loaded weapon.
Yeah.
Really.
And Mona Das, remember, she's their first term senator, and she unseated the incumbent who had been accused of, shall we say, sexual improprieties in a swing suburban swing district.
Bane.
And so she's, you know, she's not as part of the Seattle delegation, but
she's in a district that is south of Seattle, kind of the Kent Auburn area that has become less white and much more majority people of color at this point.
And you know, so she's dealing with that reality in Olympia for the first time and looking at it with fresh eyes, whereas some people who've been in Olympia a while just assume this as the status quo.
Yeah.
So it's helpful to hear this from her.
Yeah, and she didn't minimize the impact of coded language on her own work. She said, it was hard to go to work every day. The racism and the sexism and misogyny that we experienced is real, and it's not okay anymore. And when you elect people of color at the table, don't tell us to be quiet. It's not okay, end quote. So, and Das sat on some important committees this year, including the Housing Affordability and Stability Committee, of which she was vice chair. She also sat on the Transportation Committee, the Financial Institutions Economic Development and Trade Committee, and the Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee. Notably, the committee she co-chaired passed really important legislation this year to expand the use of unused public land to build affordable housing, and to and it allocated another $175 million into the Affordable Housing Fund. But the Transportation Committee, of which she was just a member, didn't make nearly as many meaningful strides towards expanding transit or cutting carbon emissions in the transportation industry as people had anticipated this year. So I'm not going to name any names, but you know, maybe folks can look up, you know, who sat on those committees with her and figure out for yourselves who she's talking about.
Yeah, it's not that difficult in some cases.
So the Secretary of the Senate asked the Senate's Human Resources Officer to meet with Doss to find out if she wants to open a formal complaint. Doss, I think, has decided not to go that route, particularly after Senate Republicans very quickly called for an external investigation of the Democratic caucus. Not helpful. Instead, she's been talking to the Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig about making institutional racism and coded language a topic for discussion at the caucus retreat in October among the Democrats. And this year, the new Democratic leadership in the Senate is seeing some retirements of older white guys and will include new deputy leaders Rebecca Saldana and Monica Dingra, both of them women of color in the Democratic caucus. It's also worth noting that the Washington State Democratic caucus contains 20 white folks and 8 people of color now. 12 members are women of those 28 members. But the Republican caucus, which has 8 women, is composed entirely of 20 white people.
Yeah, and in addition to the Senate, the Democratic House Caucus is going to be getting new leadership next year.
Yeah.
And there are a number of people competing for that gig. And these kind of considerations have to be a part of that decision as well.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. We have the final district of your district-by-district wrap-up.
Yeah, the District 7. That's my district. Just want to say that up front. I have a little bit of a personal stake in this race because I live in that district.
Yes, and I have lived in that district for 4 years, and I just moved. So
I've
certainly been watching it.
I live in an apartment in Lower Queen Anne, so I'm a renter. So you know where I live in the district and what my concerns might be. District 7 is the downtown core. It includes South Lake Union, Belltown, as well as downtown, Lower Queen Anne and Queen Anne Hill, Interbay, which is the area between the low-lying area between Queen Anne and Magnolia, and it includes Magnolia. Sally Bagshaw is the current council member who's decided not to run for re-election for that district.
And District 7 is, present company not included, the wealthiest of the 7 districts.
District 3 may have some isolated neighborhoods that are a little bit wealthier, but I think downtown.
Yeah, I'm talking about overall.
In terms of
District 3
property.
Being Capitol Hill, that's certainly trying to catch up. But with all the downtown interest, District 7 is easily the most wealthy right now.
Yeah. So as I've done in the past, I'm going to talk about the candidates with the ones that have raised the most money first at the top of the bill. That means Andrew Lewis is the first candidate in this race. He served as campaign manager for Nick Licata's 2009 re-election campaign. He's also served on the city's Rental Housing Inspection Stakeholder Committee and the Seattle Human Rights Commission. He is a Seattle public prosecutor in the city attorney's office, but I think he is probably the most progressive candidate in this race.
And he's relatively young. I remember meeting him when he was in his 20s and working on Nick's campaign in 2009. He has since picked up a lot of experience, went back to, I believe, graduate school, and now he's running for city council, and he has this young go-getter persona. I don't know how well that serves him on the campaign trail, but he's very bright and very aggressive.
Yeah. At the District 7 Candidates Forum, he's the guy who worked the room the best. He introduces himself by first name to everyone who wants to talk to him. He's very personable and very smooth, and he really knows how to run a campaign. His policies also are the most detailed and well thought out. For example, on housing and homelessness, he wants to build 5,000 units of affordable housing in 3 years. And we have not seen anybody bring a proposal to the table in any of the candidates' races that would build that much housing that quickly. But he has a plan for how to do it. through the Home and Hope program, which builds housing on underutilized public land with funding from state, county, and nonprofits. He wants to increase funding for the Rent Stabilization Fund, and kudos to him for knowing what that fund is called, because there are a lot of council members who talk about that but don't know the name of that fund. And he wants to change the nature of the navigation team from police staffing to one that consists primarily of EMTs, or emergency medical technicians, who help the homeless find shelter and eventually stable housing and provide them some kind of services, whether or not they want to get off the street in that moment.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense in terms of the kind of literally social work that
needs to be done.
Needs to be done. Yeah. And right now, the navigation teams, they're not trying to find shelter. They're just assisting the police in sweeps.
Yeah.
That's the primary function when under Mayor Durkin.
When there is an EMT there. Yeah. On public safety, he wants to hire more patrol officers who would walk a beat and do community-style policing. And he supports strong civilian oversight of the department. He mentions a number of existing diversion programs that he would like to expand, and he knows the names of those diversion programs, unlike other council candidates. And he would like to establish a drug court to divert more people with substance abuse issues from the current court and jail system. And he has experience in the current court system, so he knows that the diversion programs are great, but having a drug court would handle a lot more people. And instead of dumping ex-cons directly onto the street with no resources, he would like to establish a supportive release center to provide up to 24 hours temporary housing plus referral services to get ex-cons back on their feet after release, so that they don't end up living in a tent like so many do.
And one of the dynamics now is you can tell when there's been major releases from King County Jail, because the encampments in places like the park next to King County Courthouse fill up. And it's literally people who have just been out of jail and have nowhere to go.
Yeah. And at the District 7 Candidates Forum, he was one of two candidates who stood out for knowing quite a bit about city government and city politics. He is most interested in working on affordable housing issues. Lewis has raised almost $75,000, with 67% or two-thirds of that in democracy vouchers and a small $350 of his own money. 58% of his contributions are from District 7. That's a good sign, more than most of the candidates in the race. 10% are from District 6 and 9% from outside Seattle. 22% of his contributors are over $200, so the rest are under 200, which is also a good sign. His largest contributors include former Mayor Wes Ullman, current City Council member Lisa Herbold, former City Council member Martha Cho, and current District 6 candidate Heidi Wills, who donated in November of last year before she jumped into the District 6 race, and a number of other politicians, including Gail Tarleton, Larry Phillips, and Lloyd Hara. His endorsements include a long list of labor unions, including the Teamsters, a couple of SEIU locals, and the ILWU Local 19, that's the longshoremen, and of course the MLK King County Labor Council. He is also endorsed by the King County Democrats and Young Democrats and the 36th and 37th District Democrats. His campaign's being run by Parker Dawson, who formerly worked on City Council member Teresa Mosqueda's campaign and spent 5 months interning in... Wait a second. Never mind. Okay, so let's move on. The second candidate in the race is Jim Pugel. He's a former assistant chief and interim chief of the Seattle Police Department, where he worked for 31 years.
And his name is going to sound familiar to people who've been activists over the years, because he was also a spokesperson for the department for a number of years.
Yeah.
And he was heavily involved in the West Precinct, which covers downtown. He was often the site commander during protests and was known for being pretty much a straight shooter, unlike many of the people in SPD.
And who came later. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's most known for working on drug reform policies, especially with helping to get the law enforcement assisted diversion or LEAD program up and running, which diverts low-level drug dealers and users into treatment instead of jail. As interim chief, he struggled with a culture at the Seattle Police Department that was resistant to police reform. And I think that's eventually one of the reasons why he left the department. Now, on housing, to look at his policies, he supports strategic upzoning with affordable housing requirements. Not a lot of specificity there. He's also for instituting a progressive capital gains tax to pay for affordable housing. On homelessness, he has a four-pillar approach: prevention, treatment, harm reduction, and enforcement. So he doesn't, so you know, he's not going to step back from the notion that eventually people have to be pulled off the street, even if that means putting them in jail after you've offered them housing first, which he is a big supporter of housing first. After you've offered them housing first and services, if they still want to stay on the street, then you got to arrest them. Now, like I said, he has a housing first approach that would get people off the street, then provide them with treatment and or harm reduction services first. And he hammers that point pretty heavily.
Yeah. And that to me is not realistic, because there are plenty of people who, for good reasons, don't want to go into the shelter system, mm-hmm. and there is not housing available for
them. That's right.
So their best option is the street. And there's any number of reasons for that. They can have companion animals. They can have,
they
families.
Can be a couple that wants to stay together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they can be people who've had really bad experiences within the system and mm-hmm. had their belongings stolen and a number of other problems. It doesn't reflect reality on the ground. It simply criminalized those people.
Yeah. Now, at the District 7 Candidates Forum, he was the other candidate who stood out for knowing quite a bit about city politics and city government because of his many years working in the police department. He indicated that transportation and infrastructure is the most important issue for the district because of the second light rail tunnel downtown, the light rail extension to Queen Anne and Inner Bay, the city center connector streetcar, and the new NHL stadium at Key Arena, all of which are going to heavily impact traffic and congestion. And it's very true that District 7 does have the worst traffic congestion in the city of any district, with downtown South Lake Union, Denny Way, and the Mercer Mess right in the heart of the district.
And it's one reason why I've been moving out of the district, because I thought that moving in several years ago would be nice and central. But in order to get to other parts of the city, you have to get out of downtown first.
Yeah. Now, on public safety, Pugel is the only other candidate in the district, and one of only he's the other candidate. There are two candidates who talk about public safety. One is Andrew Lewis, and the other is Jim Pugel. And one of only three candidates I've seen citywide to even mention that they want to make sure that the police reform process continues and that the city has good oversight of the police department. Pugel has raised almost $70,000, with 31% of that in democracy vouchers and about $345 of his own money. Only 40% of his contributions, though, are from District 7, and he has the highest percentage from outside Seattle, 20%. Another large chunk, 13%, comes from District 3, with its wealthy neighborhoods of Madrona, Madison Park, and Broadmoor. 58% of his contributions are over $200. As opposed to Andrew Lewis.
That's very high.
Yeah, as opposed to Andrew Lewis, where you see almost about 80% under 200. Now, his largest contributors include a who's who of local businesses, real estate developers, banks, and business service providers. For example, Jonathan Bridge of Benbridge Jewelers, Jerome and Dinah Al-Hadif of the ABC Pacific Corporation, they're developers, local developers, Mark Canlis of Canlis Restaurants, et cetera.
Yeah, I remember Jonathan Bridge because he's sort of a regressive force on the UW Regents board, or has been in the past.
Yeah, it also shouldn't surprise anyone that King County Sheriff Mitzi Johannick, former Police Chief Gil Kerlikowski, former Assistant Chief Clark Kimmerer, former Washington Supreme Court Judge Bobby Bridge, and Lisa Dogard of the Public Defender Association have also donated to him. Now, the consulting firm that he's using is NWP, which has done political consulting work for current council members Lorena Gonzalez, Teresa Mosqueda, Sally Bagshaw, and Bruce Harrell, as well as Governor Jay Inslee and Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson, among many other candidates and initiatives, including the no campaigns against a bunch of Tim Iman initiatives. So he's got the heavy hitter political consultants behind him. Now, the third candidate in the race, kind of a surprise to me, Jason Williams is the political candidate in training wheels. Really, that's how he appeared at the District 7 Candidates Forum. He has no former political or public policy experience in Seattle. He has worked as a management consultant at Accenture and Monitor Group. His clients included NBC Universal, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I looked for policy proposals on his website, but I really couldn't find any, just a lot of vague wording about, you know, affordable housing, education access, and respect for immigrant communities. At the District 7 Candidates Forum that I attended, Williams came across as very young, very unfamiliar with Seattle politics and particularly lost when challenged on what the city council actually does. But he's young and he's a personable bro, and he appeals to a lot of the high-tech bros who live in the district because we have South Lake Union there. Williams has raised about $55,000 with 59% of that in democracy vouchers and $5,500 of his own money. 66% of his contributions, that's nearly two-thirds, are from District 7, and 11% are from outside Seattle. 34% of his contributions are over $200, if we count his own big contribution. His largest contributors include a lot of Seattle Pacific University employees, for some reason, and a lot of high-tech workers. The fourth candidate in the race is Michael George. And if you Google his name, you're going to find the Wikipedia page for the gay pop star George Michael. But that's not who it is. You need to Google Michael George Seattle City Council. Then you'll have to scroll down quite a bit. When you do find his website, you'll see that it only covers three topics: housing, transportation, and education / childcare. That's because George is a former employee of Kidder Matthews, the big real estate brokerage and property management company. So on housing and homelessness, he wants to expand programs that give developers a break, like expanding the multifamily tax exemption program. Yeah, expanding, allowing landlords to get it applied to their existing buildings, for example, and expanding it from 12 months to 24 months. He would also work to exempt affordable housing from sales taxes and permitting fees. He also wants to streamline the permitting process, which would be a direct gift to developers. And he supports policies that would move affordable housing outside of Seattle to the suburbs, where it's cheaper for developers to buy land and build at a profit, but not necessarily cheaper for the low-income residents who need to commute to work in Seattle.
And contributes to sprawl as well.
Yes, it does. He's also for building affordable housing on low-lying land in Inner Bay. Now, there's a reason why Inner Bay has almost no housing, why it's mostly warehouses and parking lots. It's because no developer in their right mind would invest in building a private housing complex in an area that's likely to be underwater, literally under Puget Sound, in 20 to 30 years.
Yeah, and it's also a floodplain now, so there's insurance issues and
yes.
all the rest.
So, but he's fine with putting affordable housing there, I guess, because then the city's going to be on the hook for building dikes or dealing with water drainage issues, not a private developer if they put private housing there. George has raised about a little over $50,000 with 53% of that in democracy vouchers and $1,690 of his own money. 30% of his contributions are over $200. His biggest contributors include a lot of real estate developers, no surprise. Ryan Bain, the partner of Tim Sice, who is a lobbyist for major corporations, and Sally Bagshaw, the former who's going to be the former city council member from the district. She likes him. You know, that shows you where she's coming from, of course. 52% of his contributions come from District 7 and a full 19% from outside Seattle city limits, close to what Pugel has, including some of that real big real estate development money is from outside the city. His political consultant is Blue Wave Political Consulting, which has provided services to Senators Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, Mayor Jenny Durkin, and the Washington State Democratic Central Committee. So he also has heavy hitters behind him as well. And I should point out, too, I talked about this last week, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce PAC has endorsed in this race both Jim Pugel and Michael George for probably this reason. And then the final candidate I want to talk about in this race is Daniela Lipscomb-Ng. She's a resident of Magnolia who has no public service background that I can see. She appears to be a neighborhood NIMBY type who wants to criminalize homelessness, believes that the city is undergoing a major crime wave, and hates any change to single-family zoning because it could take away her street parking. And she really, really hates when bicyclists ride on the street. Okay. Lipscomb-Ng has raised about $39,000 with 66%. That's nearly two-thirds of that in democracy vouchers and $6,145 of her own money.
When bicyclists ride on the street, it's completely legal.
Yes, it is, but she hates it.
I'm just saying.
She hates it, yeah. 60%.
It's preferred over riding on the sidewalk where
yes,
I'm at.
It
yeah,
is.
No kidding.
Yes, it is. 60% of her contributions are from District 7. 28% of her contributions are over $200 if we count her own large contribution. A lot of her contributors are her own relatives, but she also has a long list of folks from whom she's requested the names of their employers but hasn't received or listed them yet. And that needs to get fixed soon. Otherwise, that's a campaign violation.
Yeah, Seattle Ethics and Election Committee will be all over that.
Yeah, anyone who donates more than $100 to a campaign has to list their employer's name, and the campaign and the candidate are responsible for getting that information. She has not followed through.
I'm always fascinated, and she's an example, and I think Williams, your third candidate, is also an example.
George.
Jason Williams. And having worked on council races in the past, it always fascinates me when you get these candidates who don't actually understand what council does.
Yeah.
And that in a large portion of the job is actually really tedious.
Oh, yeah.
It's, you know, zoning variances.
Little detailed things like getting the names of a person's employer if they give over $100.
Yeah. And you know, Lewis and Pugel, to their credit, understand that you have to understand that it's on the nuts and bolts of city government in order to do the job.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm also fascinated that some of these candidates don't take the time, and admittedly during a campaign, you know, time of the candidate is the most precious resource, but they have to be doing their own homework and they have to be public about what they're doing and what they're learning.
Yeah, yeah. Now, her main political consultant is WSNRG, and I had to Google and search a lot to figure out who that is. That stands for Washington State Neighborhood Research Group, a company that's not registered with the state of Washington. Instead, it appears to be the name that the Republican Party activist Manus Pierre uses for his local political activity. And she also lists him as one of her vendors, which means that Lipscomb Ng is indeed a Republican in spite of what she's been saying on the campaign trail. And that
at least she works with Republicans.
Yes, and that she is actively trying to hide that fact. Now, the other candidates in the race have raised a lot less money. That includes Don Harper, James Donaldson, Naveed Jamali, Jean Burris, and Isabel Kerner. All of the candidates except for Harper, Donaldson, and Jamali qualified for democracy vouchers.
And Donaldson ran for mayor a few years ago, also, as I recall.
Yeah, he jumped in at the very last minute and has been having trouble getting up to speed and getting donations in. So I doubt he's going to get very far. The only one of these that may garner significant financial support would be James Donaldson, but he has not been.
Yeah, and he's also a former Supersonic, as I recall.
Yeah, he has not been. Getting up to speed quickly enough, I think. So that's my District 7 roundup. The most progressive candidate is Andrew Lewis, the first candidate that I mentioned. And it looks likely that the first two, Andrew Lewis and Jim Pugel, are the ones that will make it through to the final. We definitely don't want Michael George to make it through. He is backed pretty much entirely by real estate developers.
Yeah, and that last candidate, Stephanie, what's her name?
Daniela Lipscomb.
Daniela, sorry. Yeah, no. Yeah, she sounds like bad news as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think Michael George is even with us any longer on the
George planet. Michael.
George Michael.
No, he has passed away, yes. But people still whistle his song, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go.
Yes, and Careless Whisper and a few
and
others.
Faith. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's still with us in that.
I think we just dated ourselves.
Yeah, a lot of great, you know, former 80s hits.
Yep.
All right, so that concludes the individual district wrap-ups.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, next week we'll do a little quick rundown again, and I may look back at, because I think soon here they'll have the June totals for how much in contributions they've collected. And
yeah,
those are
supposed to be posted by July 10th.
Yeah, and I expect with the mailing out of the ballots, which will be coming in the next couple of weeks, we'll see Case, the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, start to make their big donations too. So we'll keep an eye on those as well.
They're going to do that at the very last possible minute.
Yeah.
We'll start to see those flyers showing
up
in the mail.
Yeah, well, the real thing that they try and do with those last-minute contributions is last-minute media buys. Particularly TV and cable
TV and radio. And, and online.
That's really what to watch in these instances. Because they're effective, sadly.
They are.
Yep.
All right, moving on then to national. A couple of big Supreme Court.
And we should mention, if you find this information valuable, you should consider supporting KODX because it's volunteer, all volunteer run, and we are dependent on listeners for financial contributions.
Yeah, we ask you to do two things. One is to tell your friends about the station and the shows. Visit us online, kodxseattle.org. And the other thing we ask is make a donation if you can. We have a Patreon button, or you can send us a check.
And again, kodxseattle.org. And what is that PO box?
45883.
Seattle, Washington.
98145.
So
yeah. thank you for your support for those who've done it already. And for those who haven't, well, we're waiting on you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Independent media.
Yep. Here we are.
See if we
becoming
can keep it
more
along.
And more rare.
Yes, unfortunately. So.
So on the national.
On the national, a couple big Supreme Court rulings this week.
Yeah. We had two major Supreme Court rulings come out on, I believe it's Thursday. One, the Trump administration was rebuked in its effort to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census that would have almost certainly suppressed the Latino count on that census and thus, rebounded to the benefit of Republicans because they would be overrepresented in that count and in the allocation of seats in Congress, for starters, as well as all sorts of federal funding for those districts. The Trump administration had tried to make the case that this was a benign question, but certainly with the surfacing of a dead man's hard drive late in the case, where it was shown that a Republican strategist had openly discussed how to pursue that citizenship question as a way to have partisan advantage for Republicans. That was certainly
to gerrymander districts.
Yes, that was certainly important in the lower courts and in the Supreme Court's ruling on this. It was a 5-4 decision. Unfortunately, the other decision about gerrymandering districts is going to be a huge political time bomb for the Democrats after the 2020 census because the Supreme Court ruled, and this was somewhat predictable because John Roberts was the swing vote on this, and he's been hostile in the past to things like the Voting Rights Act and federal intervention in states determining who does and doesn't get the franchise. Roberts was the key vote in ruling that nope, the federal courts don't have any jurisdiction in gerrymandering. If the states want to do that, then it's up to the state courts to stop them. And that means, of course, that for the 20-some states where Republicans have control of the governor's mansion and the state legislatures, and those state legislatures will be determining lines for the new districts after the 2020 election, then they are free to use modern technology and software to gerrymander the crap out of those districts. The particular case that the Supreme Court was looking at was North Carolina, where lower courts had ruled that what North Carolina did was blatantly illegal. Now, you have to understand there are 13 congressional districts in North Carolina, and the way the state legislature drew those districts, if the state split 50-50 between Republican and Democratic votes, it would result in 10 Republicans out of those 13 in Congress and 3 Democrats. That's how you gerrymander with modern technology, and it's a huge advantage.
And that state's pretty well known for being equally Democratic, and there's probably about 50-50 split population-wise between Republicans and Democrats.
And the
right?
Republicans in those states have been quite aggressive in trying to press their advantages. Mm-hmm. In fact, when Democratic governor was elected in 2018, the Republican-dominated legislature moved to take most responsibilities away from the governor and to the state legislature as a way to make sure that Democrat couldn't do anything in office. So they're looking for partisan advantage even when it's blatantly illegal, and that is showing the way for Republicans in other states to do the same thing. Now, that changes the calculus for Democrats in 2020, who are focused right now on trying to win the presidency, of course, and also win control of the Senate. Now they have to start spending more money on state legislatures and trying to swing legislative control in some of those states as well, because that's going to have a huge implication going forward for the next 10 years until the 2030 census at minimum, and could swing control of the Republicans, certainly in the House of Representatives, could be a major issue over the next few years. So that was a very important Supreme Court ruling, and one that Democrats are going to have to look very closely at how to spend their resources to combat.
Yeah, it really does open the door now to all-out war between the Republicans and the Democrats for control of who gets to draw up the districts and how they get drawn up.
And Democrats generally have been in favor not of gerrymandering, but of this sort of nonpartisan districting thing that that Washington State does. Mm-hmm. They passed an initiative in Michigan to do something similar this past year, and they've advocated that on a national level. Of course, as long as Mitch McConnell controls the Senate, that House-sponsored bill is going nowhere.
Yeah, so that's why it's important to really focus on the 2020 elections and trying to take the Senate back, so that a law can get passed to make it
and a Democrat can sign it in the White House.
To make it a nonpartisan body that draws up districts.
Yeah, and that's part of a sort of omnibus bill of a fair elections bill that would do a number of different useful things along that line.
Yeah, including, reform voter registration practices and polling practices.
Yeah, so, the idea that one person, one vote has kind of gone out the window in recent years.
Yeah.
So trying to restore some of that.
No, we're heading towards one corporation, one vote.
Pretty much, or one corporation, many votes.
Yeah.
As many as we can print up. All right. Well, speaking of elections, there was a couple debates.
Yes, we both watched the debates.
Extravaganzas this weekend.
Yes.
Not weekend.
And there were a couple big differences between the two debates. The first night was more about the issues, with a lot more discussion and debate about policies. But it did have the air of the second stringers.
Yeah.
The second night was a lot more posturing, I thought.
Mm-hmm. About the first night was, with the exception of a one-liner from Jay Inslee, there was no mention of Trump whatsoever.
I know.
That lasted about 30 seconds in the second debate.
I know. The second night, there was a lot more discussion there's a lot more posturing, a lot more people talking back and forth and interrupting each other. In fact, at one point I wrote down, and it was fairly early in the debate, about 10 minutes in maybe, I wrote down, wow, this has gotten out of control really fast.
Yeah, and the moderators really had a thankless job.
That second night, yeah.
Yeah.
So, of course, in the first debate, I think Elizabeth Warren walked away with it. I don't think anybody could really touch her when it came to being both personable and knowing the issues and having a good grasp of the policy. And that surprised me, because I'd been thinking of Elizabeth Warren as being a policy wonk, knowing the issues really well, but not being personable enough necessarily. And apparently she has really polished those skills.
It didn't surprise me, because C-SPAN has covered some of her rallies on the stump, and she's gotten really, really good at being personable, telling personal stories to back up her I have a plan for that, and being a policy wonk as well. So there's a reason she's been rising in the polls, which is that she's been working really hard on the ground, particularly in the early primary states, to build a grassroots network, to build support, and she's been really, really good at presenting her ideas.
To speak to voters' concerns as well as presenting her ideas.
And listening as well.
Yeah, and a person who had trouble with that in the first debate was Beto O'Rourke, who surprisingly, almost shockingly, looked very anemic on a big stage in front of all those cameras. Watching him reminded me of John Kerry, who is the one person who, he knows issues pretty well, but he opens his mouth and everybody in the room, their eyelids droop. And there's this sort of narcotizing wonkiness that comes over.
And I'm not convinced that O'Rourke actually knows the issues very well either.
That's
outside
the
border.
Thing.
Uh-huh. Outside the immigration issue, which he obviously is very, very intimately involved in, having represented El Paso.
Yeah, although he was challenged on those immigration issues by Julian Castro, and
definitely got the worst of that that exchange.
And Cory Booker, and they scored points on him for that. So the first debate had, I think, a notable exchange on immigration, where the other person who got in good answers on that, in addition to Cory Booker and Julian Castro, was Amy Klobuchar, who also did very well in this first debate. too. And I think she was right up there, not touching Elizabeth Warren, but she did quite well.
Yeah.
She also reminds me quite a bit of Hillary Clinton. She has similar policies to Hillary Clinton. She also has the same kind of demeanor when she speaks. And I think a lot of the women who really came out and supported Hillary Clinton are going to like her a lot, although I don't think she's progressive enough for this year's Democrats.
Yeah, and she's I think she's more personable and more authentic than Clinton, which was the big knock on Clinton, of course.
True, yeah.
And I think she could be a formidable candidate. We haven't seen it yet, particularly with the first caucus state being Iowa, which is right next door to Minnesota. And her sort of down-home persona, I think, will play well there. But we're not seeing that in the polls yet.
Yeah, I think the other notable exchange that first night was Tulsi Gabbard making a fool of Tim Ryan over Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah.
And Tulsi Gabbard, she came across really, really self-possessed and very strong. But she's all foreign policy, and she's all warrior woman in chief, and that's not enough to get you the nomination, much less get you elected.
Yeah, and she's kind of an odd one, but yeah, she did come off well in that debate for sure.
And I noticed Bill de Blasio was the one candidate that first night who resorted to kind of Donald Trump style rhetoric, interrupting people, you know, speaking in these emotional terms rather than policy terms, trying to rile up the Democratic base. And I found that very off-putting. There are some people who respond to that. So I think based on the first debate, I would say the three who did the best were Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, and Julian Castro. Those are the three that I think did really well in that first debate. The second debate, like I said, there was a lot of heated back and forth. And I thought, you know, this got out of control fast. And then Kamala Harris stepped in and she whipped everybody into shape. And at that point, I scribbled down, if she can do this in a meeting room full of congressional leaders, wow.
No, she clearly was the star of that second debate.
She ran away with it, I think.
I think Pete Buttigieg acquitted himself very well and helped himself a lot in that debate as well. And that, to me, were the two standouts of that night.
Yeah, you know, and I love Bernie Sanders, and I loved him that second night for calling Donald Trump a fraud and a pathological liar.
And a racist.
Yeah, that made up for all of the other stumbles, I think, that he made later in the night. But I really ended up feeling kind of sorry for him. And it looked to me like he had not done nearly enough debate prep before going into this debate.
He, to me, of the second night debaters, was relying the most on his sort of catchphrases and stump speech without getting into policy details. And there were a lot of questions directed at him that he did not directly answer.
He didn't answer and didn't really defend himself on. And that's poor debate prep, I think.
Yeah, it is.
Joe Biden was attacked on his past record, most conspicuously by Kamala Harris, but not entirely by her. Other candidates went at him, too. She hit him hard on school desegregation, in particular busing.
You know, to me, one of the things that Harris does really well in these settings is she studies who her opponents are and how they're likely to respond. We saw this.
That's part of her background as a public prosecutor.
Yeah, we saw this with William Barr also in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, where she basically made a fool of him over his dissembling, because she knew that in response to her questions, he would try to dissemble again, and she nailed him on it.
Yeah.
Similarly, with Biden, who cannot ever admit that he's wrong. He's very similar to Trump in that respect.
Yeah.
He will defend his record regardless of the setting and regardless of how he's attacked. And when Harris, directs her ire at him in very personal terms, as she did, she doesn't even have to respond directly to that, because she knows how bad it will look when he responds the way he's going to.
Yeah. And at one point I was thinking, you know, just moments before this exchange, Pete Buttigieg had talked about the police shooting of an African-American man in his city of South Bend, Indiana. And he basically, you know, said, I didn't get it done. I didn't get police reform in place. And then he started talking about, this is what I have to do going forward. And that was a really good response to that question. And I thought, you know, Joe Biden, you got to take a page from Buttigieg's book, you know, learn to learn to say when you were wrong, and this is what you're going to do going forward. And he just couldn't do that. And that made him look weak.
And you know, politicians are human beings also, and all of them make mistakes at some point or another. You know, the one thing early on that told me reams about Trump, even though we already knew, was when he said, you know, I can't think of anything I did wrong in office so far. That tells you a lot about a person.
Yeah.
And I think Biden has the same flaw.
Yeah.
It's going to come to bite him.
I think so, too. And also, you know, he's a year younger than Bernie Sanders, but on that stage, he looked like he was maybe 10 years older.
Yeah.
That's a flaw, too.
Yeah, because Sanders carries himself with energy pretty much at all times when he's in the public.
And when he speaks.
And when he speaks. And Biden does not. He looked a little better than I've seen him at some public appearances. He just looks like he's got one foot in the grave, honestly. And you think, how's he going to survive until 2020, let alone 4 years in office?
Yeah.
But, he just didn't carry himself with much energy in the debate. And that hurt him as well, I think.
Yeah. And so I agree with Job. I think the two candidates that did the best in the second day were Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg. And, you know, and I think there will be a lot of progressives who think Bernie always hits it out of the park. But I think he really needs to sharpen his debate skills for the next one, or he's going to fall off the list pretty quick.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, I think if you put those five on a stage together, Warren, Harris, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and Castro, I think then you'd get a really good debate going.
I agree.
Yeah.
I'd love to see that.
I would really
so
like to see that.
So the next debate is coming up in a month. That'll be a CNN debate.
Close to the end of July. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's a...
Then they take
There's only two more candidates that might qualify for that did not qualify this time around. That's Montana Governor Seth Bullock and the representative from Massachusetts,
And
Moulton.
We'll see. Sometimes after the first debate, people start to drop out. If they're not raising the money they need to, and if their numbers drop, in the polls. And certainly there'll be a little break during August. But then for the September debate, the qualifications to get in that debate tighten. So a lot of people could fall by the wayside this summer.
And I think by the time that September debate comes around, people who don't qualify yet for it are going to start dropping out because they're going to start having difficulty raising the money that it takes to be able to travel to all these early primary states.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we should go to events.
Yeah. And speaking of money, I did see, which I know a couple of you both saw, that Biden is coming to town for money raising. So
He is.
And this weekend is Pride Weekend, and it's a particularly large Pride Weekend because it's the 50th anniversary of Stonewall.
Yeah.
So a lot going on, culminating tomorrow in the march, which officially starts at 11 o'clock at Westlake.
Yeah, today is the official Pride Fest on Capitol Hill. That started at noon and runs till 9 p.m.
Yeah, and that's Broadway all the way from John to Aloha, I believe.
And also in Cal Anderson Park today is the Family Day Queer Youth Pride Stage from 1 to 7 p.m., including the prom dress rugby, which is one of my favorites, at 1:45. Tomorrow, Sunday, is the larger and more corporate Pride Fest.
Seattle Center. The staging for that backs up all the way through downtown.
Yeah, so that starts at 11 a.m. with a march through downtown to the Seattle Center and then festivities at the center throughout the day. Monday, the city council will hold its full council meeting to approve the bill to expand accessory dwelling units in single-family housing zones. Come and show your support for that bill. That's at 2 p.m. at 600 4th Avenue at James Street in downtown. Also, Monday is a rally and ride with the MMIW Riders. MMIW stands for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. The MMIW Riders are Indigenous women on their Harleys who have been traveling to bring awareness to this vital issue. At 4 p.m., they will start with a prayer circle, followed by a rally at 4:30, and then at 5 p.m., that ride will start. That's at Westlake Park, 4th and Pine downtown, and they welcome other riders to join them. Next Saturday, July 6th, is International Action/Solidarity Day for Immigrants at the Northwest Detention Center, hosted by La Resistencia and ODA. Join local immigrants and activists in a rally demanding release from detention, better conditions, living wages, united families, and access to identity documents.
Yeah, that's shaping up as a fairly major rally.
Yeah, that's going to be from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. at the Northwest Detention Center at 1623 J Street in Tacoma.
So for anybody who can get down there, it's well worth the trip.
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll plan on seeing you both back here next week then.
Next week.
We'll do our best.